Penetrating and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning. So, I will be talking about the Prajnaparamita, and particularly in light of the Heart Sutra. Sorry, I'm a little slow. I'm adjusting my my video. Mary asked me to give this talk. I'm Steve. I'm a senior student here, I guess, is what they call me. And when I get nervous about a lecture, I sometimes wonder how senior I really am, like right now. But that's okay. Good morning, and thanks for coming. The Heart Sutra is, we're studying the Heart Sutra in class right now. And right now we have gone through quite a bit of it. We're on we're halfway through. And so I wanted to emphasize the idea of, as I said, the Prajnaparamita. And as a reminder, the Heart Sutra is the way to get us past thinking that the world as we see it is the world, and that particularly that our self, which is, which we tend to think as real, we think of as permanent. On some level, even if intellectually we know that's not true, there's a part of us that wants to really hold on to that idea of the self. And the Heart Sutra has the an archetype of wisdom, Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva, speaking to Shariputra, who's kind of an archetype of knowledge, Buddha's best student, is saying to Shariputra, compassion is saying to knowledge, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. That which is form is emptiness. That which is emptiness, form. And by that, we're taken to look past our knowledge about things and to go deeper and to notice the way that everything is connected and impermanent. So emptiness means that nothing, including you and I, have a self that's separate. And it goes on and on and on without limit. The later in the Heart Sutra, after going through all of the Buddhist traditions at the time that the sutra was created, all of the lists, all of the whole, you know, map of the universe and of the human consciousness and psychology, which was actually very deep and extensive. After going through all that list and saying, don't hold on to any of that. That's just the map. It's not the territory. After saying, no, 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 there's none of this. Then the Heart Sutra goes on to say, with nothing to attain, a bodhisattva depends on Prajnaparamita, and the mind is no hindrance. Without any hindrance, no fears exist. Far apart from every perverted view, one dwells in nirvana. In the three world, all Buddhas depend on Prajnaparamita and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. A bodhisattva, of course, is a saint in our tradition, essentially, but it's also us if we're practicing and we want to try to save ourselves and others from suffering. We vowed to do it, even if we've said the vow that began the lecture. We're probably baby Buddhas or baby bodhisattvas. So we may not be saints yet, but we're walking in the same footsteps as the saints. With Without any hindrance, no fears exist. Far apart from every perverted view, one dwells in nirvana. In the three world, all Buddhas depend on prajna paramita. Prajna is wisdom, and the paramita is usually translated as a perfection. There are six perfections. I'm not going to go into the others today, but they have to do with ethics, patience, things like that. And prajna is the last and the greatest, and the one that all other, everything else depends on. Sort of like ways of loosening our grip, ways of becoming bodhisattvas, ways of being useful. So I'm going to start with saying what prajna is not. And the Heart Sutra specifically says that that there's no attainment and also no cognition. So we've already established it's not cognition. And that brings up for me the fact that, in fact, I tried to make it about cognition and reflection all the time, despite what the Heart Sutra says. And also in a book called Each Moment of Is the Universe, I think that Uchiyama Roshi really pretty much nails it on the head. He talks about reflection as something that gives rise to suffering. It's not just, there's many kinds of suffering, of dissatisfaction in the world, from, you know, not getting what you want, not being with the person you want, not being where you want, being with someone you don't want to be with. The list is pretty exhaustive, and the Buddha and the early Buddhists came up with some great lists of things that give rise to dissatisfaction. Uchiyama wants to focus on a particularly deep one, which is the human tendency to reflect. He says, when we want to eat something, we do research. Maybe it's right to eat meat, maybe it's not. But no matter how long we research something, we're always going to have more questions. Are you sure? Is this right? So it's complicated. And that is something that leads us to dissatisfaction and away from wisdom. Although, because form is emptiness and emptiness is form, there's a way that maybe we don't want to make too much of a thing of the difference. I mean, form is like not only all our lists, it's also our bodies and our present, anything. And emptiness is the lack of self of those things, the lack of own being. So Uchiyama Roshi says in Each Moment of the Universe, how does suffering come from reflection? From the point of view of time, as impermanence, to reflect is to rebound. It means to arise from the source of existence and appear as a human being. Moment after moment, we reflect, we rebound from the pure, clear basis of existence and appear as particular beings in the phenomenal world. Because of the constant reflection, we feel that we exist as separate beings, and then we want to know the source of our being. We want to know it, but the source cannot be grasped by our human consciousness, so we are dissatisfied and we suffer. I often find that the edge of my practice has to do with attempting to be present. Mary always says, don't try. So maybe the attempt is part of the problem. But the idea of what is now. The Heart Sutra doesn't particularly list now or the present as something we should say no to. It says no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. It pretty much gives us everything. But I think it's implicit. To me, there's no present either is implicit. And there's none of these things, because that's where we find our lists. That's where we find our concepts. At least as, and I'll go into this a little bit more, because it's complicated. It's I have another quote from Uchiyama, the same book that I think is really relevant to that, where he talks about wisdom. He talks about bouncing back from those moments, and we've all had them, those moments where the self seems to go away. The self, we get involved in something, but we're not there really. We act in a way that we don't expect us to, whether it's standing up to somebody and going, oh, I didn't know I had that in me. Whether it's getting involved in art and the time just passes and you're in the flow, or exercising when you're in the zone. Could be pretty much anything. It could happen in Zazen even, believe it or not. I say that ironically because some people think that they're going to sit Zazen and then they're going to like have their self fall away and they're going to find Nirvana, and often it's somewhere else, but Zazen can set us up to let go a little bit more. So anyway, Uchiyama Roshi says that we bounce like all the time. Maybe we don't even know it, but we touch reality. We touch emptiness, and then we bounce back. And it means touching the truth. But we don't know it because there's no sense of you there, of me. It's only later on reflection that we can say, oh, where was I? And it's very uncomfortable, as I mentioned in class. He says, after bouncing, we touch the dualistic world on the other side. So he's talking about it as being sort of a partition between emptiness and between touching emptiness and our ordinary life. And he calls that dualism. That's why Dogen Zenji says, when one appears, the other is in darkness. As long as you touch the moment, I'm reading from Uchiyama here, as long as you touch the moment, it's wisdom. When you return to the dualistic side and know that you touched it, it's not wisdom, it's faith. In the dualistic world, wisdom turns into faith. I want to take a pause and just ask, is this resonating with anyone? Or do you have any comments or questions so far? Yeah, Jody.
Can you read that last line again? That felt like that was, I need to hear that again, if you don't mind.
Absolutely. As long as you touch the moment, it's wisdom. When you return to the dualistic side and know that you touched it, it's not wisdom. It's faith. In the dualistic world, wisdom turns into faith.
Steve, was that word faith with a TH or fate with a T?
TH.
Thank you.
And it's, this lecture isn't about faith, so I don't have anything to read about it or anything, but I will say that in Buddhism, faith is not, it's not the same as we talk about in the West, particularly in the monotheistic traditions. Faith in Buddhism is more about experience and beginning to trust your own experience, not the words of the Buddha, not the words of Uchiyama Roshi that I just read. You begin to have a sort of buildup of, they call it not putting another head on top of your own head. So,
Steve, I have a question just to clarify. So what I understood you to say in that last, you know, kind of couple of minutes is that, you know, when we're away, so to speak, like lost in something and really present to what we're doing is another way I hear that, whether it's art or exercise or something or a moment where we just do something. That's the reality or the one side of duality, right? Reality. And that when we come back from that and we're aware of kind of aware in a different way, I guess, more conscious of oh, I'm here now in this chair doing this thing, and I'm thinking about what I'm doing, but that's not reality. And that's the other side of the kind of the dualism.
Let me try to back up a little bit then. Words make this very hard to express. So I think that what Uchiyama meant by dualism is our normal thinking mind. Mm-hmm. That there isn't actually dualism. There's not an actual partition between no self and self, between form and emptiness. That's what the Heart Sutra is about. It's about there not being dualism, there not being a partition. Form is emptiness and emptiness is form, and prana is to intuit that, not through reflection, but through touching it. But because he has to speak, Uchiyama is talking about bouncing back. He's talking about from when we try to talk about it, even to ourselves, dualism comes up. So I'm talking to myself, oh, where did I go? Then I've already said, where did I go? I've made a separation between myself and something else that I'm thinking of as emptiness or no self. So he's saying that wisdom is, you're just there. It just, there's no question about it being other and me. Then you come back and you start to reflect and you're back into the suffering world and you're confusing yourself. But he's saying even that is a place where you can have some faith that you don't say, oh, damn, I lost it. You can say to yourself, ah, that was kind of like have a sort of a loose grip on it. Say, let me just sit with this some more, or let me, you know, let it be what it is. Continue to notice. Don't strive after getting it again, which is Zen students from beginning to advanced do that. I had an enlightenment experience. Now I don't. Where'd it go? How can I get it again? Then you're in language, and then you're bringing up more suffering for yourself. So don't do that. Is the Heart Sutra saying no, not that either. Kate.
This is great to think about, because I think my understanding of what he's saying too, to sort of carry on, is that we have the experience and we've all had them, you know, moments. But because we live in space and time, I mean, we live in the phenomenal world, we bounce back to that sense of what happened being separate from where we are when we bounce back, if that makes any sense at all. And so for me, I think when he says faith, it's kind of like trusting, just having some kind of trust that happened, you know, or that it's possible for us to become more aware of emptiness, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
Yeah, it makes sense to me. Jody, how do you feel? I see you nodding along like it's clearing up for you, but I don't want to assume.
No, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think it's an important place that I get to when I do reflect and I think, wow, I was just like yesterday, I spent 4 hours painting and I was completely just, it wasn't like I looked out the window, realized it was dark and I just spent 3 hours, 4 hours painting that I was like, wow, that was, whoa. And I guess I still kind of hold on to the enjoyment of, wow, that was like 3 hours of just like not trapped in my mind. I was just in the moment doing something clearly. But I do think that, I guess I just still enjoy like thinking about that. I was actually really present a little bit ago, even though I don't really remember it all, but in hindsight, I know I was there. And maybe I think that's an important place to be, that just, I think it's helping me become more aware that there's two separate spaces, right? Because I guess it's all the same, but somewhere in there, I think it's important to have some thinking about it. And maybe at some point later, I won't need to, because it'll all just be whatever. But yeah, I get it. I feel like it's coming to me. Yeah. In short answer, yes, I get it. I think I'm getting it.
Good. And we'll never stop reflecting and thinking. So feeling that it's wonderful or feeling uncomfortable with it is part of the process too. And it is part of the universe that we exist in. So we don't want to try to not be human. Zach, and let me make sure that Kelly, I can't see you right now. So if you do have something to say, please just, speak, because I have a tablet. So
thanks. No, I'm fine. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks.
I just wanted to say Mary has a great saying, living in the relative world with the mind of emptiness. And it's kind of a way of thinking about it, that you're kind of in both places at once, or there aren't both places, or however you want to describe that. But we're Homo sapiens. We can't just live in emptiness. And our mind doesn't work that way, but I think we can glimpse it and appreciate it and be aware that we've had some experiences or glimpses, and I think it's helpful.
I like that phrase as well. So another thing that occurs to me as I'm trying to be present is that sometimes it's impossible because I expect, and this was pretty much already brought up, but I expect to be there. I expect that I will be present. And so that means that all the categories that I have of the world would come with me, and then I would be in the categories and not present. So I do have a real example of this, I just want to touch on that I think that sometimes people, including myself, are influenced subconsciously by Pop Zen. Pop Zen being, hey, be in the moment. It's the eternal now. And so I've had somebody tell me, why don't you just tell me exactly how you feel? Isn't that what Zen is? Totally spontaneous. And they don't practice, and they're telling me what it is. It's not so much that, well, yes, I do think, well, you don't even practice it. I do have that, but that's not the point I'm trying to make. Particular example that comes to mind is if I remember that early on in my practice, I was telling somebody who didn't practice, yeah, I'm really trying to live in the moment these days. And the person said, oh, well, be careful. You've got to be concerned about, you can't just live in the moment. Be careful. And the person was thinking, I meant, I'm going to selfishly get what I want. I'm going to live in the moment. And that's I think none of us who practice a lot consciously think that, but somewhere you know, our ego is so strong that, you know, we want to be in that moment. We want to have our ego self experience the present. And if you can just sit with it and loosen that a little bit, it avoids a lot of suffering. So I wanted to talk about a recent experience that's really the edge of my practice right now is that, as I think most of you know, I had to put down a cat that I had for 17 years that was a companion and friend. And talk about trying to be present and actually being, in a way, forced to be present. It seemed like it was just yesterday that she loved it when I would rub her cheek. A lot of cats do that, rub her cheek. For some reason, they love it when you touch their faces. And so she loved that. Then she got cancer on her right cheek, and I couldn't use that cheek because it was very fragile. She had a tumor there. And so I would, and this was within the last year, and it was growing and growing. So what happened to that moment that seemed always so present when I was, especially for her, even if I was distracted, she was so present if I would rub her cheek. And I had to be careful with that cheek. And when I was there, I would have to be present in a different way and say, okay, be careful, don't get the right cheek. And she would still love being rubbed on her left cheek. And she would demand that I open the door wider than I used to because she had a chubbier cheek than she had in the past. And it was kind of cute. And then she used to love food. And that was a constant thing. And then she didn't love food. She stopped eating at the end. And a week ago from Friday, we had a mobile vet come over and put her down. And she sat in my lap, and there was a moment where she was trying to resist the sedative, and another moment where she stopped resisting and her breathing stopped. So what was that? And now, today, I got up and half expected to hear begging for food, hearing the cat, seeing the cat. I see something about cat shape and size around the corner, and oh wait, and I remember. So I'm present with the absence of Bruta. And so if I try to force myself just be present with what really is, does that mean don't think about it? Does that mean don't care and don't notice? If you've had that experience, I'm sure you know just what I mean if you've ever missed somebody or an animal and they still seem present. But the Prajnaparamita, the wisdom of it, is to not force anything, not force myself to be, quote, present, to be empty, to say, all life is empty. Form is emptiness. There never was a cat. There's no cat. There's no me. There's no sadness. There was no joy. There's no joy in remembering. Because form is not different from emptiness. The other part of that is that emptiness is not different from form. So it's like saying, be present in this situation and don't be present of yourself or don't be present of all these things. It's sort of like saying, don't think of a carrot. And I challenge you right now, don't think of a carrot. Raise your hand if you've succeeded in not thinking of a carrot. Should I give you a little longer? No, we'd be here all day, right? We can breathe into don't think of a carrot, right? Breathe into don't think of a carrot. Eventually you won't think of a carrot. and you can touch wisdom. The Heart Sutra continues with within the three worlds, all Buddhas depend on Pranayaparamita and attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. I meant to mention this earlier, and forgive me if I didn't, but the three worlds traditionally refers to past, present, and future. So that's one of the reasons I'm spending so much time emphasizing the present, because it's fairly easy to look at the past. There are even sayings about it. The past is a memory. The future is a dream. Today is a gift. That's one saying that I know of. And it's easy to see that the past doesn't exist anymore, and the future future doesn't exist yet, and all we have is the present. In the three worlds, all Buddhas depend on Pranayaparamita. In the three worlds, wisdom is telling us that to depend on Pranayaparamita is to see form as emptiness and emptiness as form right now as well. Let go of what we think is now. To be present is to let go of what we think of as now. And to stop not trying to think of a carrot. Did you stop? Had you stopped? Raise your hand if you'd forgotten I said to think of a carrot. Only Joey? You were all still thinking, trying not to think of a Dana? Did I just see that? No. Which is the real Dana? The one before, the heart, or the bird? Oh, I love it. So I'll get off the carrot. Do you have a question?
I just want to say both are true. And can I make a comment about the earlier thing? Or are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. I'm a little slow to comment. I was going to say, as someone who writes a lot, you were talking about how words are kind of the torture point, right? Mm-hmm. Of the thinking mind, right? So someone who wants to express through poetry or words, it feels like a constant torture, honestly. And then I noticed the Dharma is written, and even that has to be let go. And I think I hear some things in the chants about that too. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense as someone who writes. It feels like the myth of Sisyphus, like this never-ending torture to do it, and you feel called to do it, and yet what are you, the hell are you doing? Because it's so entangled. And so poetry ends up being a language of your heart, and you put it out as sort of like a piece of art, but it's never, I'm always worried that something is going to be a problem for someone else. So sometimes it feels easier to be quiet, like all the time, and like to not do it. You know what I mean? But at the same time, you can't do it. So it's confusing for me in terms of what I find I lose myself in writing and gardening, which also feels like I'm attached to some future plant in my mind. Anyway, that's all I would say.
Well, that's right. And it can be torture. But, one thing is that there is no... there's no form and emptiness in that either, because haven't you ever read a poem and felt something you couldn't explain? And
oh yeah, especially with I can't say his name right, Hanshin or whatever, the Cold Mountain. Mm-hmm. All the Japanese poets are my favorite.
and they kind of don't leave a trace in your mind, but at the same time, each time you read them, there's a different texture and a new truth. So they're beautiful, beautiful. I shouldn't even say beautiful because that's like naming the flower, right? But yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very critical when I'm writing as well of myself. And perhaps Dogen was self-critical, or perhaps he got beyond that. Perhaps all of them have had at least an element as being human. They probably have some self-criticism. Hopefully with years of Zazen, we can loosen it a little bit. And I'm not going far, but I just realized that the book I was about to quote next is still on the table where I was making some last minute notes. So I'm grabbing those. I'm glad you mentioned poetry, because I have there's a very poetic quote from Dogen that's in Moon and a Dewdrop. And it's on, it's in a section called Poetic Imagery. And I'm not sure if you'd call this a fascicle. I wasn't familiar with it until I happened upon it recently. It's just called The Moon. And the Heart Sutra says that we, depending on Pranya Paramita, we attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. The moon is often seen as a expression or a symbol of enlightenment in Zen. So here's what Dogen says about the moon. He says, the moon is not one moon or two moons, not thousands of moons or myriads of moons. Even if the moon itself holds the view of one moon or two moons, that is merely the moon's view. It is not necessarily the words or understanding of the Buddha way. Even if you say, there was a moon last night, the moon you see tonight is not last night's moon. You should thoroughly study that tonight's moon from beginning to end is tonight's moon. Although there is a moon, it is neither new nor old, because moon inherits moon. I'll read that again. The moon is not one moon or two moons, not thousands of moons or myriads of moons. Even if the moon itself holds the view of one moon or two moons, that is merely the moon's view. It is not necessarily the words of understanding of the Buddha's way. Even if you say, there was a moon last night, the moon you see tonight is not last night's moon. You should thoroughly study that tonight's moon from beginning to end is tonight's moon. Although there is a moon, it is neither new nor old, because moon inherits moon. To me, that goes back to the question of, where am I now? What is this moment? It brings up the question of can you turn enlightenment on and off at will? Can you talk about it? Is every experience of enlightenment different? Are there a thousand experiences? Are there as many of them as there are people? Or is it one? Somehow we wind up talking about it. We wind up talking about Pranya Paramita right now. We talk about enlightenment in Zen. We talk about practice enlightenment, which is a Dogenism, to try to get us past thinking that enlightenment is something separate to attain from the forms of our practice. So, you know, it brings up, why can we turn it on and off at will? Enlightenment? Can we? I don't want to make this about trying to understand every single word used in the poetic imagery I just read. but I will open it for questions about it, if you have any, or I also could read a selection from Suzuki Roshi's if there's no questions. Zach.
I love the Heart Sutra. I don't claim to understand it completely. I have like little thoughts, but it strikes me that that's why we practice. I mean, that's why we sit zazen, is to let go and be open to things. And, you know, maybe after 100 years, I'll understand the Heart Sutra. But even though there's no path. but I think to me, it sort of points to practice, and thinking of Dogen when his question of, if I'm already enlightened, why do I need to practice, kind of thing. And I bet I understand it more than I did 5 or more years ago. I can't quantify that in any way, but so I guess I'm just thinking about practice today, talking about the Heart Sutra, and that's the slow, methodical, not rewarding in any kind of palpable way to kind of live what the Heart Sutra is talking about. Do you have any comments about that? And also, do you think your cat was living in the present all the time?
Moo. That was a little glib of me. There's a traditional Zen koan of, do dogs have Buddha nature? And the answer is moo, which means neither yes nor no. What's my actual answer to that? Yeah, I do. I feel like for the most part, animals live very much in the present, and particularly my cat. Though, you know, there's always nuances and complexities, because when she wanted her food so much and nothing else mattered, was she thinking about the future, or was she in the present with her hungry belly? I don't know. I could never ask her that. I'm tempted not to read Suzuki Roshi because it feels like we've already talked about this, but I think I will read it anyway. He writes in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, in a section called No Dualism. There are a bunch of very short lectures that were transcribed and cleaned up a little bit to take out all the ums and ers and whatever else. He wrote, when you find it difficult to stop your mind, you are sitting, and when you're still trying to stop your mind, this is the stage of form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Which, while you are practicing in this dualistic way, again, remember, dualism means your words, more and more you will have oneness with your goal. And when your practice becomes effortless, you can stop your mind. That is the stage of form is form and emptiness is emptiness. To stop your mind does not mean to stop the activities of your mind. It means your mind pervades your whole body. Your mind follows your breathing. With your full mind, you form the mudra in your hands. With your whole mind, you sit with painful legs without being disturbed by them. This is to sit without any gaining idea. At first, you feel some restriction in your posture, But when you're not disturbed by the restriction, you have found the meaning of emptiness is emptiness and form is form. So to find your own way under some restriction is the way of practice. I see him as challenging us to see that even to say form is emptiness is to create a dichotomy in our practice in our lives. To say that emptiness is form is to think that there's something different and be held hostage to language. I think he's saying just sit with it. It's very ordinary. Form is form and emptiness is emptiness too.
Yeah, I like the idea of ordinary. You know, I think often I'm trying to, you know, when I'm trying to do something that's not, that I perceive as not ordinary. So, just like that beautiful thing you read about the moon, you know, and just looking at the moon. It's not yesterday's moon. It's not the future moon. It's the moon that I'm seeing in this moment. And then the next moment, it's another moon. And just, you know, we have to think. So just holding it that way impacts how I experience things from moment to moment, you know. And I actually here where we live, I go out on our deck each night and look up. It's just become a habit I've had, and it's great because it's always changing, you know. Sometimes there's a moon, sometimes I don't see a moon. So, and there's this beautiful story. I'm sure anybody who has a grandkid or a kid knows it, called Goodnight Moon, that I read to my granddaughter over and over again. It's just a series of saying goodnight to everything, you know, goodnight moon, goodnight stars, goodnight chipmunks. It goes on and on. It's very sweet. And, I feel like I'm rambling a little bit, but I really like, I think part of my attraction to Zen is how grounded it is in the ordinary. It, like, we don't have to go off and do all these special things. And I mean, Zazen, yes, but pretty much it's really about ordinary experience. I mean, living each moment, each day, and making an effort to understand that it's all right here, you know.
And I would add that it's a different moon each night. But Dogen would say, but don't think it's two moons and don't think it's myriad moons.
Right.
The moon is the moon.
The moon is the moon. Yeah.
Kelly, I'm again going to make sure that I didn't miss you because I have to, you probably see me occasionally doing this, but I want to make sure that you get a chance to, you know, reflect anything or.
No, I'm doing fine. I actually have I'm up in the cat's loft, and so there's a cat using me as a scratching post at the moment. And so,
okay. I hope you're wearing jeans or something.
No, and You know, I knew the job was dangerous when I took it.
Jody.
So on the theme of cats, I'm looking at a picture of our cat who we also had somebody I met come out, and we did a home euthanasia with her November 16th. We've had her 14 years. And, you know, we had this book made with all these pictures of her, and every couple of days I flip the page and have a new picture of her sitting there with, it's like a little remembrance. And so I just want to say, I understand that feeling of that you talked about. I've been through that. And it's odd because at some point I'll need to close the book, but it doesn't feel right to do that. Like, you know, like I want to hold on to, when I look at her, I have a lot of joy that comes, but then there's also some sadness, and maybe that's the suffering, right? Like I'm just, by the nature of doing this, it's sort of adding, continuing what is sometimes the suffering of it, but it's like, I don't mind that. It's like, because there's a balance of joy there too. And, so anyway, that just touched me when you talked about that. And then I also, we have two other cats that are still with us. And when they sleep, you know, sometimes their paw is kind of jerking. And I know that they're dreaming. So when you said, you know, maybe cats are always present, I don't really know, because even in their sleep, their mind is busy doing something that clearly, you know, I mean, they dream probably like I'm dreaming. I think it's real. I'm, you know, it's very vivid, or I can taste something in my dream or whatever. And, but maybe with cats, when they wake up, they're not really contemplating their dream or thinking about it. They're just boom, doing whatever they're doing. But I do clearly, when they're sleeping, there's something going on for them that feels real, and their body's reacting to that. But I think maybe they have a better grasp on how to work with that. They just let it be. They don't do what we do and reflect on it, think about it, and tell everybody about their dream and analyze it and do all that. So I guess what I'm saying is, in my next life, maybe being a cat would be maybe wonderful.
In conclusion, I think that one can be present in one's dreams. And I would bet that if anyone has a good chance of being present while they dream, it's a cat. I think it's actually a little bit past time. So it's probably time to just let it be. Let it be. Okay. So thank you everyone for the great feedback, for being here. I wouldn't have had anyone to talk to if you'd all stayed home. Well,
we so did stay home.
Oh, darn. You mean I'm just talking to an empty wall? Anyway.